Hello and welcome to a brand new episode of the Film Stage Show. I am your host, Brian J. Rowan, and this is the official podcast of thefilmstage.com. With me, as always, my two partners in crime, Danny King, a contributor to the Film Stage.
Hello. Happy Halloween week to all the listeners.
Woo! Happy Halloween. And then we also have Associate Editor Nick Newman.
Yes, happy Halloween.
And then we also have a special guest today, Mike Anton, the editor of The Inclusive and a contributor to The Film Stage.
Hello, everyone. I hope you're enjoying your storm surge.
Yes, we are trying to get this out ahead of Hurricane Sandy, so hopefully you all can download it and listen to it on the dying light of your cell phone as the hurricane slowly ravages everything you love. Wow. Happy Halloween, people. It is a brand new day, which means that we're going to be having a brand new show, which means that we're going to be talking about a brand new movie. This week, we're going to be talking about Cloud Atlas, the newest film from the directors of The Matrix, as well as Tom Tykwer, who directed Perfume and Run, Lola, Run. It stars Tom Hanks and Halle Berry. But before we get into that, we're also going to have a movie discussion that's going to tie in a little bit with our feature film discussion. We're going to be talking about books that are considered to be unadaptable, the movies that have been made from them, and we're also going to give you our choice for an unadaptable book that, for some reason, we'd still kind of like to see someone try to tackle. After all of that is good and done, we will talk about our recommendations for the week ahead, both in theater and DVD, and then we'll give you a random recommendation of something that we saw on our own in the past week. So let's dive into it. Let's talk about some unadaptable, quote-unquote, books that have been turned into movies. Nick Newman, you don't get to start us off this week because we have a guest. Mike Anton, as the guest, why don't you start us off?
You boys are so polite.
We try to be.
Well, I try to be. Good, at least one of you does. Chivalrous boys, you. My most unadaptable film was one that I actually really, really wanted to make into a movie that really did not turn out the way that I wanted to. It's Watchmen. The Zack Snyder comic fest that came out a few years ago. And they tried to cram nearly every bit of this mammoth book into a film, which was a really not the best idea possible. It was long and overwrought. It had some nice bits of, you know, oh, that's right, that was in the comic. And you go, oh, that's right, this is also in the comic. It ruins all drama. So that was both sad... day for me as a fan of the comic and as someone who actually likes movies. So that one,
ooh,
wow,
that one hurt me.
Yeah, you're gonna get some arguments here.
Please. You're not gonna get one for me because I still haven't seen that movie. So that's a whole different kind of sin. But yeah, Danny and Nick, anyone who's seen it, do you have any rebuttals?
Yeah.
Okay.
I kind of do too.
I think it is exciting and strange, and I think it's daring even, which is not a word I like to use that much when I describe a big movie. But I think it is fantastic, particularly when you pair it with the graphic novel. I think that it actually grows in that sense, which is kind of weird because it should stand on its own, and I think it does. But yeah, I think it's a fantastic movie. It's not exactly like the graphic novel. I think there are key differences which help it stand apart. And I think there are moments of beautiful cinema in there.
See, I would have thought, not having seen it, I can't say anything for certain, but when I did read that, I had the impression that it would be unadaptable, if only because of the strangeness of the conclusion. But it is my understanding that they've changed it from graphic novel to movie, correct?
Yeah, the change conclusion is bad.
Okay.
Yes, very much so. But and that's the thing is, I think there are moments of that that were great and daring and gorgeous. I mean, some of those shots, the opening alone is phenomenal. But then they take so much of the comic that doesn't really need to be there, and they pick and choose these different elements that I would have preferred they take 20 minutes out of like the backstory of different people just to get to the ending that they had in the book, which I thought was genius and brilliant, and the one they have in the movie exists, and that's a bit different. So,
Danny, why don't you give us your selection for a book that you thought was unadaptable but got made into a film?
Well, kind of in general, I'm not completely on board the whole unfilmable concept, but a movie that I saw last night that clearly most people thought was unfilmable was On the Road, Jack Kerouac's Beat classic. And it's a movie that's kind of been in the works for 4 decades or something crazy like that. I think Francis Ford Coppola was the first one who bought the rights. And I really enjoyed the movie. And there was a Q&A afterwards with the screenwriter, Jose Rivera. And he talked about how no American studio would put any money into this movie to distribute it, even though it's a classic seminal American book. And he kind of just talked about how the stigma of the novel being this kind of meandering, fluid thing just made it an unfilmable concept in most people's eyes. But, you know, I think it really works as a movie. And there are people might be surprised how different it ends up being, because one of the things they did is rather than adapt the published version, they went back and researched Kerouac's original scroll, which he wrote from his typewriter, and it's different. There's more explicit sexuality, and the first line is much different than it is in the published version. And it gives the movie kind of an interesting through line, even though Rivera was pretty adamant about the fact that not only were a lot of things cut out from the movie from Cannes because they had to cut it down for distribution, but he also said that the director, Walter Salles, kind of goes off on his own path sometimes, which is kind of why he likes to work with him, but it also frustrates him. But overall, I think it's a really good movie, and it's kind of just funny to me that it took something like this 4 decades to be made, because it's not like you'll see it and find it completely more messy than a lot of the other movies you've seen. It's just kind of a standard road movie given a really good directorial touch.
Interesting. Nick, what about yourself? What is something that you thought was unfilmable that they ended up making anyway?
My example of a book that is quote-unquote unfilmable, which was nevertheless, maybe against better judgment, made into a movie, is Cormac McCarthy's The Road, which was directed by John Hillcoat. It came out in late 2009. But, you know, a great book, but one that is very much reliant upon you, the reader, to have a more emotional reaction to it. And the film itself, I don't think, is very good, because it basically takes the unrelentingly bleak nature of the novel and translates that literally, which doesn't work in a filmic sense, because what is very oppressive on the page just becomes boring and drab on screen. That was a huge disappointment for me. I just pretend the movie doesn't exist, honestly, because it almost tainted the book for me.
Really?
Yeah.
I say that because I could have sworn that we had a moment where we were talking about it, talking about Lawless and The Road, and that you said you didn't not like it.
No, I don't like it.
I like The Road. You might have been.
Maybe I thought we were unanimous, because I like The Road. Very different from the way I like The Road as the novel. I still appreciate and really get into the movie as well. But yeah, what you're saying, I mean, Cormac McCarthy is the kind of author where not much will happen, and it's all in the way that he says it that draws meaning. So yeah, adapting that full bore was a little foolhardy, I believe. Especially considering the fact that, like, yeah, you're right. It's a drab, crazy, depressing slog of a movie. But for some reason, I'm still into it. So I don't know. I don't know what to tell you about that one. Danny, you said you liked it, so obviously you kind of feel the same way.
Yeah, I mean, I just liked it as an atmospheric experience. I think I think that movie and The Proposition, even more so than Lawless, are both just really potent in terms of the worlds they create, and they're very bleak. So, I mean, it's off-putting stuff, but I really appreciate it.
Though for some reason, the post-apocalypse still looks more inviting than the Australian outback.
Yeah, I'd give you that.
Did you read the novel, The Road?
I haven't, no.
Okay. Mike, did you ever read The Road or see the movie, The Road?
I have done neither, because I have no culture or class.
All right. I'm willing to accept that excuse. It's good that you actually said The Road, because I was gonna bring that up, and I was struck between that and a second movie that I wanted to talk about, which is Naked Lunch by director David Cronenberg, based off of the William S. Burroughs novel. And that novel, I read it when I was in high school, and by that point the movie had already been out. But I mean, I read the novel and I was like, how can there be a movie about this? This is ridiculous. This is insane. It's a drugged out beat odyssey through a weird non-country where everyone does drugs and they're aliens, and it just doesn't make any sense. And I think Cronenberg went the right direction in kind of using some of the aspects of that novel to create a strange sort of biographical story about Burroughs. I don't know. Has anyone seen Naked Lunch?
Yeah, I have.
Yeah.
Okay. So you know what I'm talking about. Like, that movie's insane.
Yeah.
It's like living cockroach typewriters. Aliens with how do you even explain the aliens? With their addictive cum. I mean, it's ridiculous. It's a ridiculous movie, and yet somehow, when juxtaposed against the novel, it makes sense that you would have to film it that way, because there's no possible way you could go for it in a literal adaptation sense. So I think that that's one of the few examples of really going for broke on something and trying something new and succeeding.
Yeah, I've never read the book, but I do quite like the film.
The book is okay. If you like the beats, like, that's great for you, but I have a very low tolerance for their madness, so it's reading that book was kind of a shock to me and to my system, because I was like, what is happening? Nothing is happening in this book. I'm just reading a series of escalating, like, dares to the reader, which was less than awesome. So now, to close out, why don't we go through in the same order and talk about a book that we have read, that we've enjoyed, that we think is unadaptable, and just give our brief reasons, perhaps, why it's unadaptable. So, Mike, lead us off.
Oh, thank you, sir. Mine would be Chuck Palahniuk's novel Lullaby. It's my favorite book from the author.
Oh, man, I hated that book.
I loved it because it felt like a movie to me. It was a road movie, like People Got Out, but it has so many weird little tangential elements that will never really make it on screen. I mean, the whole point of it is that there's a culling song that you sing and then babies go dead, which is not the most commercial thing.
I was about to say, that alone would keep it off of the theaters.
Because who likes dead babies in such piles? But it's a really interesting film. I've really enjoyed the characters, although the one female lead's a bit shrill and kind of annoying, and I'm sure that will not translate well at all. But
the hippie character was shrill and annoying, too.
Yes. There are a lot of people that are shrill and annoying, which makes this hard to adapt. But there's something about the story itself that I always clung to. There's something about that as a road movie that I thought would have worked out really well if everything else in the book didn't actually exist. So.
All right. And Danny, what about yourself?
Well, kind of in keeping with the theme of my other choice, I would mention J.D. Salinger's Catcher in the Rye, which is another kind of American classic that has this stigma behind it that will probably never allow it to be made. But it's the kind of thing that I would be interested to see, especially because it seems to me like any director could kind of pull this thing off on a pretty small budget. And it's a novel that meanders a little bit. So you could really kind of have a filmmaker put their own personality into it. Like, if you look at the movie we'll be talking about today, Cloud Atlas, there are so many events in that novel that you kind of have to stick to. And Catcher in the Rye strikes me as something that you could kind of take the spirit of and do something interesting with. And I think it could be done in a variety of ways, and I would be up for seeing it.
I don't know if that could ever be made into a movie, just because so much of it is internal. And
that's one of the reasons why it could be something that could turn out a lot differently.
Yeah,
depending on the filmmaker.
Yeah, it would. I was about to say it's like the perfect blank slate for a filmmaker to kind of like work their style in. But I don't know. I've seen a lot of movies from books that were internal. Like, I mean, you know, basically like The Road, you know, you can have all the events happen, but without that internal life of the characters, it kind of feels a little flat. Speaking of The Road, Nick, what do you think would be a book that could not be turned into a film?
You mentioned one comic, so why not mention another? In terms of things that could not be turned into a movie, I'll say Why the Last Man, which is a comic book which was published a few years ago, ended about 5 years ago. It's about... Does anybody know what this is, what I'm referring to?
Yes. Assuming it is about The Last Man.
Yeah. For those who don't know, it's a comic book about this plague that wipes out every living male mammal on Earth except for this one guy, sort of this slacker type, and his pet monkey, who is also a male. And he has to get to Australia to find his girlfriend, but everybody in the world wants to get their hands on him, either for government purposes or for sex, because he's the only man left. And it's his trip around the world over the course of 60 issues. One of the best comic books ever published, I would say.
Really?
Yeah, it is incredible. It's one of the best science fiction stories I think I've ever encountered, actually. And I know that there are plans underway for a movie. Just recently, New Line Cinema had found a pair of writers for it. Louis Leterrier tried to make it. So did DJ Caruso, with Shia LaBeouf in the lead role.
I was going to say, I think I remember hearing about Shia LaBeouf being up
for that. There was a lot of fan outcry about that. He'd actually be a perfect choice, but that's a different discussion. The problem is that it's a comic that really you kind of need to pack everything in with. I mean, if you think Watchmen is difficult to adapt into a movie, this would be harder because it's so much longer. And, you know, they're going to try it, but I don't know. I feel like it'll lose a lot in that in the film setting. It just doesn't really match with that. So I'm kind of dreading seeing that.
The eventual day when it does get made. For me, I'm going to discuss a book called House of Leaves by Mark Daniel Wesky. I probably am mispronouncing that, so I don't even know. House of Leaves is a book that is, I guess the best way to describe it would be like a found footage book, a found novel perhaps. And aside from just that, I mean, you could very easily do something related to that. But the reason that it's so, in my mind, unadaptable is because the story itself is indelibly linked to the form of a novel, like pages bound together. The basic story is about a tattoo artist, I believe in LA, who goes to an old man's apartment after he dies and finds a dissertation sort of academic breakdown in the man's apartment on a film that doesn't actually exist. And so the book is written as the tattoo artist's notes and amendments to this old blind man's academic thesis on this movie that doesn't exist, that was a documentary about a family living in a house that they discover is bigger on the inside than it is on the outside, and who suddenly start discovering new rooms and like massive hallways. Not only that, but I mean, there's an extensive glossary at the end of all this other information that informs the rest of the book, and certain pages will have hidden codes on them. And there's a section where there's a box in the middle of about 10 different pages with a whole different story happening inside of that box. So I can't imagine what you would have to do and how much you'd have to change it to actually make that really incredible novel into a movie. It just seems close to impossible to me.
From your description, it seems like that would be the case.
Yeah, right? Actually, there
I
was...
I want to read it.
Yeah, no, it's really good. I recommend it to anyone. Something to keep in mind is I think there was an AV Club article recently where, or I guess it was just an interview, where they talked to him because his new novel just came out called The 50-Year Sword. And it too is kind of a, you know, toying with the novel medium. He was saying that in trying to adapt it for an ebook, which I would love to buy just to see how the hell they did that, that it did open him up to the idea that perhaps it could be adapted either into some sort of miniseries or a movie. So I'm just like, I'm now kind of really interested to see how that would turn out. But I think it's impossible. I think that brings us to the end of that discussion. We've spent quite a bit of time talking about that, and we have a 3-hour movie to talk about, so we should probably get to that. So now is the time to talk about Cloud Atlas, the movie starring Tom Hanks, Halle Berry, Jim Sturgess, many others, directed by Tom Tykwer, Andy Wachowski, and Lana Wachowski.
This is the Cloud Atlas sextant?
I doubt there's more than a handful of copies in all of North America.
But I know it. I know I know it.
That's it. The music from my dream.
There are whole movements I wrote imagining us meeting again and again in different lives, in different ages.
I can't explain it, but I knew when I opened that door, a powerful deja vu ran through my bones.
I heard it in a dream. I was in a nightmarish cafe, and the waitresses, they all had the same face.
Cloud Atlas. This is a film that I don't even know if there's like a really good way to convey the plot of this film with any kind of brevity. It takes place in 6 different time periods with multiple actors playing multiple parts throughout those time periods, and it's all about how people do stuff, and that stuff makes other stuff happen. So let's talk about this film. Mike, why don't you start us off? Give us your impressions of this film. What did you think about Cloud Atlas?
Well, let's see. I enjoyed it in the sense that it was a big epic film event thing. I mean, I don't know if I'm ever going to watch it again, but I definitely enjoyed my one trip through Cloud Atlas's long kaleidoscopic view of humanity against itself for hundreds of years and 3 or so hours. It was good. It's a bit overwrought and weird and interesting, and it's tough to, obviously now you hear me, it's meandering, but it's tough to put it into one sort of idea because it's so big, and at the very least it makes me think about trying to answer this question, and I find it hard to do so. So that's kind of a good thing, I guess.
I guess that is one way to look at it. Yes. Nick, what about yourself?
Let me start my review the way Cloud Atlas starts. Let me tell you a story about
dramatic reinterpretation.
Okay, so my thought process while watching this movie went something like, oh, I hate this. Oh, yeah, I like it. Yeah, this is pretty good. When does this end? Is that the plot? Oh, okay, sure, yeah, yeah. All right, this is good. Yeah, this is okay. Yeah, all right. Really, that's the makeup? Wow, sure. Yeah, cool. Yeah, all right. So that was my thought process watching this entire film. Ultimately, I did like it. But it's a reaction that comes by mixing many different reactions. Unfortunately, there was some hatred in there and almost no love overall. But there was admiration. And I think that the first 30 minutes or so of this movie, maybe not 30 minutes, let's say 15, cut it in half, if you will, are awful. The first 15 minutes of this movie are so bad, and I remember thinking like, oh, fuck, I'm here for 2 hours and 45 minutes. And there was sort of an ebb and flow because I was enjoying it and it was going along. And then there was a certain point where I was about ready for it to end, and I, you know, discreetly, of course, looked at my phone, and I realized there was a fucking hour left of this movie. And then
Holy shit, I did the same thing.
and then it sort of I got settled back in. And then ultimately I enjoyed it. So I know my reaction is all over the place, but so is this movie.
That's a very good way to put it. Danny, you actually read this book, so why don't you give us your, you know, vaguely more informed decision, maybe? I wouldn't say informed. Just, you know, you have a context we don't.
Yeah. The big structural difference between the book and the movie is that the book begins in the oldest plot line, then works its way up to the futuristic plot line, and then goes backward and ends up in the ancient timeline. And each of those segments is about 40 or 50 pages long, And so you really have time to kind of settle into each universe. In the movie, once it gets going, they cross-cut between the timelines pretty quickly. And that was one of the reasons why it was tough for me to get invested on a personal level. And I think part of that is because the sense I got of like these directors, it was almost like they read this novel and they made this movie as like a test to themselves. Like, oh, how cool would it be if we could turn this into a movie? We could keep the same actors and it'll be awesome. And that's kind of like how I watched the movie. Like, I saw Tom Hanks throw a guy off a building and I was like, oh my God, like, what the heck? But then it didn't really kind of stick with me on any sort of personal or spiritual level that it's going for. So, I mean, I feel like a jerk for like putting a movie like this down, because it obviously represents something ambitious and that, you know, isn't going to get made too often. But I do think that it's sort of like a bit of a misjudged piece of storytelling.
I do not feel like a jerk putting this movie down. Because it forced me to spend 3 hours in a theater silently wishing I could kill myself.
Oh my God.
Jesus.
That's a bit hyperbolic. Let me begin anew.
Maybe a tad.
I've seen some terrible movies. This was not as bad as some of them. I think we all know that I was not looking forward to this film. We can say that. And I actually have already had to face some blowback on my opinion, because people are like, well, you wanted to hate it. And I was like, you know what? I don't want to hate anything, because I have to see that thing, and why would I want to hate it? Hatred is not a fun emotion for me. So I went into this film, and I had seen all the marketing, and honestly, like, if I see a house on fire, I don't have to sit in the living room for 3 hours to know it's going to be hot. But, you know, I went and saw it, and I thought to myself, you know what? I'm going to give this movie a chance, because odds are that you just can't market this well. Like, there is an opportunity, and I was thinking about Margaret. If I had seen the trailer for Margaret and people started telling me how good it was, I would have thought they were out of their goddamn minds. But that movie's a piece of, like, a masterwork. So I was like, maybe that's what's going to happen with Cloud Atlas. And I was not into it, but I was on its level for maybe 30 minutes. Because I was like, wow, there's a lot of, like, craziness and audacity here. Like, maybe they're gonna pull this off. They don't. I can't think of a movie that I've never been I can't think of a movie that I've ever been so disengaged with. Like, it's not even a movie that's like so bad that it becomes fascinating in its own way. Like, this is just a dull, like, overwrought, pointless film. I did not like this at all. And I just remember sitting there, and every time it would jump to a new storyline, I was just like, why? What am I doing back here? I honestly don't care about this character. Move on. Give me someone that I can feel something for. You know, there's like in a normal movie, because you care about characters, there are emotional highs and lows, and the situation will change, and your feelings towards that character and that event will change. And in this movie, I felt such utter apathy towards everyone. That it doesn't matter if someone's getting poisoned. It doesn't matter if someone is, like, running across, like, the 400th story of Neo Tokyo on a ridiculous, like, escape hatch to nowhere. Like, I didn't care. Like, every time someone died, I was just like, okay, well, he's gone now. That's one less character I have to keep track of. And all the symbols for all of the continuations through time were so over-obvious. And not only were they over-obvious as symbols, but then they would just straight up say, oh, that's weird, I had a friend who had that same birthmark. And every time a new birthmark would appear, the camera would just, like, be there and show you it and be like, do you get it? Do you get recurrence? Oh, wait, you don't? Here, we're going to have someone write something called recurrence.
Every time a connection would show up in my head, I'd go, ah! There we go, ah!
And there were moments in the movie where I saw what they were doing, and I was like, oh, that's like that. I can kind of get behind that. Like, that's cool. And then a character would be like, oh, that's like funny. This makes me think of this. And I'm like, you know what? It loses its power if you point it out to me. It's like a joke. When you explain the punchline, you suck all the air out of it. And this movie is like a joke whose punchline is just continuously getting explained to you. Like, a horse walks into a bar. It's like, okay, now to get this joke, you really have to know that, like, a horse is a four-legged mammal used as, like, a pack, and, like, you know, a bar is a place where people go to get drinks. And it's just like, shut up, please. 3 more hours of this nonsense. Danny, when we were talking about Dark Shadows, I had mentioned the fact that I wasn't wearing a watch and I didn't want to check my phone because I didn't want to be that guy, even though I was only in the theater with two other people and I was in the back row so no one would have known. I respected the form of cinema too much to check my phone to see how much time I had left in Dark Shadows. I had absolutely no problem checking my phone three times during this movie. So that's my thoughts on Cloud Atlas. And
I guess I'll try to defend at this point.
Yeah, if you'd like, you can, you can come at me.
Kinda. Yeah, I'm gonna really come at you. Believe me, with kid gloves.
You don't want none of this, man.
Don't worry, I don't. The thing that I think's tough is that they really thought very hard that people wouldn't get what was going on. When it's sort of the recurring themes are supposed to be the point, where it's the oppressed are always held down by someone in power. But it's you can understand that without everyone putting on the different weird makeup that takes you out of the whole story itself.
Yeah, the people in 1970 San Francisco, they're working in that room with the fruit or something, right? Remember that? They're oppressed. They're enslaved.
Yes.
Oh, my God.
Yes, and you have to be nice to them by not shooting them in the face, which Hugo Weaving doesn't. So 1 point humanity. Huzzah.
Hugo Weaving, who is the only character in this movie who has no evolution. You know, everyone else goes from a shitty person to a godlike figure, but Hugo Weaving's always nuts and actually just turns into the devil.
Hugh Grant as well.
Oh, that's right. Yeah. So Hugo Weaving and Hugh Grant were just just slowly becoming more evil. Anyway, Mike, continue, please.
There isn't really much. I mean, for me, it's tough because I took this as sort of six short stories that were sort of put together. There were about six 40-minute short films. Yeah. I liked some more than I disliked others. I did have a good time with all the old people trying to escape nursery home. I thought it was kind of nice. It wasn't anything crazy. It was a good thing to watch. The whole thing in Neo Soul just struck me the real, I think it was the opening action scene in Attack of the Clones. So, you're already losing if that's the first immediate thing I think of. So that's not good for anyone. It was all over the place. And it's weird because the gimmicks sort of take over the idea of a plot. And the idea of a plot is sort of people kind of suck a lot all the time. So we should get used to that. And if all of humanity should be together, that's a great idea. But if they're against you, you should senselessly murder them all the way to death a lot in front of children. And that's okay.
Murder them all the way to death.
All the way down to death, Mr. Roan.
I love that term.
Thank you.
Yeah, I want to go back to something that you said. When you first began, you said that you felt they didn't think their audience was going to get what they were saying. And I think that is the most infuriating thing about this movie, is that these people claim that they wanted to make a movie that would plumb new depths and make you think about things and would put ideas into your head that you'd never felt before. And the idea that they think that people have never thought this before is so fucking arrogant. I hate them for it. What is the big groundbreaking, thought-provoking message of this film?
Clearly there is one that you're very angry about, so
but
please.
But there's not. That's the problem. There's not a big thought-provoking message of this film.
You just said there was. There's a very arrogant one.
Yeah, no, I'm saying that what they perceive to be thought-provoking is freshman year stoned, hey man, everything is connected, man. if you save a slave, that slave is going to stop someone from poisoning you, and then you're going to stop slavery, and then on and on and on.
Well, he doesn't stop slavery.
No,
he personally does. He stops it with his thumb.
Yeah. With his thumb?
Yes.
It's pretty powerful.
He's a pretty big dude.
They have these ideas of and then someone writes a piece of music and it keeps recurring throughout the entire film. Sure, I'm still listening to Fur Elise play on people's goddamn cell phones in a movie theater. I'm aware that when someone does something, it sticks around for a while. These are not big concepts. These are not things that us poor plebs living out in the boonies haven't thought about before. And the idea that you're going to dress this up and, make me sit there for 3 hours looking at computer augmented people who look like reject characters from the Fallout series. It was like personally insulting. Like,
I don't think they're no, but I fundamentally disagree. I don't think you interpreted it correctly, frankly. I don't think that they're trying to say that this is the most amazing idea in the world. I think they're just saying this is a idea in the world and that they took the time to display it and show it. But I don't think they're presenting it as a mind-blowing thing, personally.
Have you read
I would say it's sort of mind-blowing couch within $100 million weird sci-fi movie with six different narratives that go all over the place. Like, that I think is more of a groundbreaking element than like, we're all together all the time.
Yeah.
I agree with that, but I also, you know, it's tough for me to think about what the people wanted and then the movie itself. Like, I carried no baggage into the film about like what they said or how they were going to blow my mind completely. So maybe that does, you know, pepper it more for you than me. But like, it was interesting in the way that they presented it in the case of it being $100 million sci-fi movie that has to cross over to some sort of large audience for this to ever make any kind of money back.
Yeah. And the crossover appeal for this movie, for people who are going in based on the idea that it's from the directors of The Matrix, would probably be the Neo Soul stuff, which was, again, the most difficult to get into because there's only like one actual Asian actor in that entire sequence. And
So
I'm not going to get into the questions of racism because that's I don't think that's true at all, because there has been, I mean, I'm sure we've all heard people saying stuff like yellow face and blah, blah, blah. Right.
Yeah.
Okay. I am not in any way, shape or form qualified to talk about that. So I don't want to get into that. But what I'm saying is that this facial thing that they did to people to create people from different races and make them fit in other aspects, like Halle Berry as a Jew in the 30s, and the girl who plays Soon-Mi.
Dunabe.
Yes. And she shows up as a, you know, a white woman in the 1700s or something. What are you laughing about?
Yeah, well, the group of people I saw this with, Jordan and Dan among them, one of them was our friend Connor, who occasionally writes for the site, said that, do you think when the Jim Sturgis character, because, you know, that he's married to this quote-unquote white woman played by Duna Bay, do you think at one point later on he said to her, honey, I love you, but what the fuck are you?
Oh man, yeah.
Because she has the eyes of a Korean person.
She is, and, okay. Also,
and but she has red hair and freckles, so it's quite a sight.
Freckles that make it look like they skinned a bunch of toads and stretched over a person's face. It's not good. If that technology is going to be the center of the thesis of your film, it really has to be good. And it was not. Like, I'm not even talking about if it was an intelligent choice to try to do that. I'm totally fine with you doing that if that's how you feel like you need to tell your story. I'm talking about just pulling it off, and it never works. There's never a point at which I lose the knowledge that that is a computer creation or even like makeup. I don't know what level of alchemy they did to make these people something else, but it was almost universally always a failure. It was a ridiculous failure. These, like, the Caucasian people who are made to look Asian come off like fish aliens. Like, there's it's this weird, and it takes you out of the movie, and you can't pay attention to anything that's going on because all you can focus on is the wrongness of that face.
That wasn't a problem for me,
it
honestly.
Was a massive problem for me.
I thought James D'Arcy actually looked pretty good in the makeup.
Really? Oh, he terrified me.
He was the fish monster for me. He was the alien fish monster. Like, it was awful. He looked like an alien from fucking Close Encounters of the Third Kind. It was weird. I didn't like it. It was, and I couldn't do anything else whenever those scenes were playing.
One thing I've heard proposed, which I think is actually kind of interesting, is that in this future of 2144, there's been enough sort of crossbreeding between whites and Koreans to create people who are sort of a you know, a mixture in that sense.
But
which
if
I think actually makes sense.
I guess, but if that's so, then don't put an actual Korean actress next to these people, because now all I can, because it's not even, if that's what they were going for, then that's great. But it's still a failure in terms of actually visually getting across these things. Like, when I'm so focused on the artifice of what I'm seeing, any hope that the illusion of the movie being true is going to overcome me and, like, make me love it is lost. That hope is gone. I couldn't do it, guys. Tom Hanks's false teeth in the 1700s section were the same thing.
Oh, that was bad.
Let's move on from the makeup, seriously.
But see, that's the problem for me, is like so much of this movie for me is predicated on these choices they make that don't come off. Like,
but let's talk about some other choices.
Okay. I do want to ask one question before we move off. There was the AV Club interview with Andy and Lana, and Andy said, why would you want to limit yourself in terms of the tools you use? It just makes sense that you would try to use new tools, new innovations to make new kinds of movies. The interviewer then asks, there isn't much of that in Cloud Atlas, except the transformational aspect of changing the actor's race and gender. Lana then states, it's the most experimental tonal structure in the history of cinema. Agree or disagree?
No. Disagree.
Yeah.
I mean, it has to, though. Like, you have to. They're talking, like, they didn't rewrite the script of how you tell stories. They told six of them on top of each other.
Yeah.
That just seems pretty normal, I would say.
You don't think that changing the races was the most experimental tonal structure in the history of cinema?
I mean, it certainly will challenge your audience to keep yourself invested instead of going, oh, look, it's James Darcy as an Asian person.
We'll see. Yeah, I know that they said that it's experimental, but really we've seen it before in Breakfast at Tiffany's and Mrs. Doubtfire, so I don't think it's that experimental.
Oh, come on. That's a completely different example, and you know it.
It's not. Okay, you can't tell me that Hugo Weaving in this movie as that nurse was not basically just young Mrs. Doubtfire.
No, but it's a completely different purpose. Come on. You're being intentionally antagonistic here now.
I'm not.
Because it's entirely different.
Because it's not entirely different.
No, because there's a different purpose behind it.
But the effect is the same. You know that that's not that person. You know that that's not what they are and who they're like. And
well, no, actually, that's incorrect, because that's who they are in that story. It's not necessarily the same character, and it's in a different story. That's ridiculous. Come on.
If you say so.
Well, no, that's how it is. It's a different story. It's not the exact same character.
But you can't. What I'm saying is that when you move to that story, I have to believe that these are distinct people from the people that they play in other ones. I have to lose the actor into six different characters instead of just one.
I'm not sure about that.
Okay.
I don't think that's the exact intention, though.
What would you think the exact intention is?
Well, it's supposed to be the same soul that carries on. And part of the idea is that, with the exception of Hugo Weaving and Hugh Grant, it shows that people can change over time. They can be bad in one timeline. They can be good in another. And there's always room for that sort of change. So, yeah.
Well, based on that thesis, then it's the filmmaker's idea that you actually get taken out, even temporarily, to realize, like, oh, it's that actor playing this role throughout the entire film. Which
I think a lot of the time, yeah.
I mean, yeah. That's a ballsy move. I'll give it to him. But
I think that's very much the intention, though. I mean, how do you not recognize Tom Hanks in all of those stories, or even Hugo Weaving? There are a few instances where you won't recognize people. But those are more fun cameos. Like, Halle Berry plays an old Korean technician, and Ben Whishaw played the elderly wife of Hugh Grant in the modern day set story, for example. Those are fun cameos more than anything else. I mean, they might have a thematic purpose, but they're not intentional in the sense that Tom Hanks as the weird Irish author in one story is.
Was he Irish or was he Cockney?
Pretty sure he was Irish.
I don't think he knows.
Okay. Yeah, we can move away from all that talk now. Nick, you had said you wanted to talk about something else. Why don't you throw us out a topic to discuss?
Well, I wanted to talk about the use of editing in this film, because I think it's very peculiar. Mostly good, actually. I would say that it is... I mean, this is an obvious comparison, but it's not unlike D.W. Griffith's Intolerance in the way that it matches the stories and it makes them connect and has them rhyme with each other. And I was impressed by that. The beginning was actually my least favorite part, because that's when it spends the most time establishing each section, and it dragged there. It felt a bit, it felt very choppy and just clumsy. But once it gets into a certain rhythm of spending a few minutes with one and then going to another, I was really engaged by that, even if the movie was at times not working.
Thoughts, gentlemen?
I'm a little bit more mixed. I agree that it helps the rhythm of the film, because unlike you guys, I definitely wasn't like bored. Like, I didn't check my watch at all, and I think that the cross-cutting was part of that. But it also, to me, some of these worlds I just like didn't believe. Like the Jim Sturgess and Tom Hanks stuff on the boat just never compelled me.
The most simplistic
portion. Yeah. And then the one on the opposite end, the stuff in this like a post-apocalyptic future or whatever, is almost going to be inherently troubled, just because they have to talk this language and I didn't understand half of it, and it's a little bit silly. I think even if you would ask like Tom Hanks, he'd be like, "Yeah, I was a little uncomfortable doing some of that stuff."
Yeah, I was saying it's funny how everybody talks like a slave master in a section where there aren't any slaves.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Why was the devil from Hugo Weaving in the far future talking like a plantation owner in the like 1700s?
Because the devil likes to enslave people?
I was going to say, I mean, I'm sure you could make that argument. I mean,
I just made that up.
Well, it was pretty astute, sir.
No, I mean, it makes sense. I was going to say, I mean, he's got the highfalutin slave master thing, and I guess there's a case to be made for the fact that, like, this, you know, devolved language would be the type of thing that would be analogous to, like, the, I'm thinking of, like, the old... I don't want to say minstrel show, because that's really loaded, but you know, there's the cliche about the slave who, you know, doesn't have the same verbal skills as the person mastering them. Obviously, I'm trying.
I mean, okay, you got there.
You did it. I don't want to just come out and say, like, every time you see a movie that has slaves, there's the thing about them not being able to talk well. I was trying to dance around that, but you know, that's the truth. Like, they make fun of it now, but that's how people used to, like, I don't know. I'm trying not to say something racially charged.
You're done. You did it. You're good.
Sweet. Anyway,
you got it.
Yeah. What did we think about that Hugo Weaving, now that we're on his character there, old Georgie? Did everyone sync up with that? Was everyone cool with that?
The devil?
Yeah.
I didn't, because it felt, it felt weirdly mismatched in the rest of the movie, which I think, I'm not going to necessarily say it was the devil, but I think the movie takes sort of almost an atheistic stance on the way life works. And to introduce that element, which could be religious, feels like a mistake. And I just didn't understand exactly what it was, like if it was actually real or if it was just an illusion. But either way, I don't get why it's there.
This is going to be another thing, Nick, where you're saying I'm just going to try to be antagonistic. Have you seen the movie Mr. Brooks?
No, I don't know what that is.
Okay, I'm trying to think of the actor's name now, and I'm having such a hard time with it. Kevin Costner.
Yeah.
Kevin Costner plays a man who likes to murder people, and William Hurt is the manifestation of that desire to kill. So it'll be like these two guys talking to each other, and it's supposed to symbolize Kevin Costner's like internal debate about whether or not he should go back to his murderous ways. And that movie didn't work. And I feel like the old Georgie thing here was basically an extension of that that also didn't work. I don't know that it was necessary to have like a literal devil when you could just do something that wasn't quite so obvious. Danny, I'm assuming that old Georgie was from the book.
Yeah, but it's not, I mean, if I remember correctly, it's not like a it's like a, just a conversation he's having with himself. So it's kind of like that Mr. Brooks thing.
Yeah.
But like the weird thing about it to me, and it's even more kind of off-putting when it's on screen, is that that character just seems like a normal guy. So like it's just weird to me that he's talking to this green guy the whole time when Tom Hanks is playing other characters that are seem 10 times as more disturbed than that guy.
That's a very good point. Yeah, the old Georgie stuff kind of threw me for a loop, just because, I mean, this is a movie that every piece of this film feels distinct from every other piece in a way that makes the continuity between all of them really difficult to manage. For instance, let's do a little thought experiment. You wouldn't say that Caddyshack takes place inside the same movie universe as The Road. Like, if I showed you those two films and then told you that The Road was a sequel to Caddyshack, your mind would have a really hard time making that connection.
Although it still would be better than Caddyshack 2, but yeah.
Oh, man. but what I'm trying to say is you can have these different stories and they're all happening, but the tone and the just the feel, the tactileness of each different story is so distinct from every other story, except perhaps for the two that take place in the past. I'm not counting the 70s one because that was like an episode of Shaft or something. But I can't, in my head, I know they're connected, and I know that this is telling a single story throughout all of human history, but the differences in everything are so extreme that it is almost impossible for me to actually convince myself that this is a single timeline. Like, the transition from monkeys to spaceships in 2001 makes more sense to me than anything in this film, even things that are just 30 years apart.
Yeah, but you know, I think that was sort of the goal of it. I mean, I understand the idea and the conceit about how like souls get older and they learn things. That was never really my part of it. Essentially, it's, you know, six meditations on the same theme, which is what humanity is doing wrong to itself over and over again. Like, I think it's more vindictive of everyone than like these like seven or eight people, because then we get into like crash territory and no one wants to do that.
No.
But I personally found the different tonal shifts inviting, because I don't want to sit there and go through the same sort of emotional beats all the time, even though they're telling essentially the same six stories in some way, shape, or fashion. And I kind of liked how it was so tonally different, because then it sort of begets more thought about humanity itself and how they keep manifesting these problems over and over and over again. So, I know I read Will Leach's thing on Gawker about how much he disliked the tone shift. I mean, that's what made it interesting for me, is that I kept going different stories and having these different sort of things to look forward to. Like, I really enjoyed the relief, if not the real humor itself, of the section of the retirement home, just because it was such a respite from everything else, and old Georgie talking to Tom Hanks in his ear. Like, I liked how they kept flipping that out.
But see, to me, like, that old person's home ground this movie to a fucking halt. Like, anytime I was getting invested in anything, and you go back to this zany little caper that these old people are having, and I'm just pulled out. I'm done. Like, you can't get me to be interested in something or continue to carry any kind of emotional weight. Like, there should be, if I'm not seeing a linear story, there should be a tone that will carry me through and can continue to make me have that internal journey with these characters. And when you have a man being poisoned on a ship, a fabricant for some reason being broken out of jail again and again and again, and then you have a dude who's just trying to get out of an old folks home because his brother put him there because he was fucking his wife, I mean, that doesn't work. It doesn't work for me. Maybe you all didn't have as much trouble with this as I did, but it destroyed any momentum that this movie would built up in the interim. Nick or Danny, thoughts?
Well, I mean, it didn't work for me in terms of, I just didn't have an emotional reaction to the movie. Like, I've read reviews where people are saying, like, you know, it comes out, they come out of the movie and they like their belief in humanity has been restored and all these things. And like, I wish I could have felt that, but I was just kind of like on an even keel throughout the whole thing, even while all these completely other different things were happening. So, I mean, I guess that also disappointed me because I wanted to obviously feel something, but I would say that the nursing home story is at least intentionally light and comedic. Some of the other tonal shifts, it's hard to say if they were aimed at or if they were just a result of kind of the difficulties of trying to realize something like that. Like in the two timelines I mentioned, like the earliest one and the latest one, it seems like a lot of the difficulties there are just those are kind of tough things to capture convincingly.
I felt at times the momentum was being halted, but once it got into the sort of a central story, I think that it started to carry itself pretty well, and I didn't find there was a huge issue with in that regard.
Okay. Danny, you brought up an interesting point. Going into this movie, I read a lot from people who were saying how emotionally moving this film was. I think I read one critic who said that he was in a screening, and when the lights came up, like, no one could meet each other's eyes because they'd all been crying. Did anyone on this podcast have anything approaching that kind of reaction to this movie?
No.
Okay. Because I'm wondering about that. Like, I'm not that dead inside, right? I mean, I can be moved by a film. I can't conceive of a mindset that I would have to be in for this film to move me that way. And well, I'm just trying to understand, like, what I want. I would love to have one of those people write us an email and just, like, I'm not doing this because I want to mock you, by the way. I didn't like this film, but I totally understand if you did. I would love to know what you got from this film that none of us did. I would love to hear your sincere, honest reaction to this film and how it moved you in that way. Because I really do feel like I'm missing out on that. Like, the idea that some people are getting that and I'm not is actually kind of like a letdown to me. Because that was the one hope I held out for this movie, that it would stun me and renew my faith in humanity, or like make me realize that something, just do something to me.
Something, the small stakes of trying to rejigger your entire idea of humanity. So, you know, tiny thing to have happen during 3 hours of a film.
But I'm just saying,
that's for me, I never got into this as an emotional investment or with any kind of stakes. I was going to sit there to be looking at pretty colors and things. Like, this was a movie that I detached immediately from. I couldn't get over the artifice of it because of all the different actors that were used. I mean, that was a problem for me. But I never thought I was going to, like, weep or do anything. I mean, it's the same emotional beats, essentially, all over the time, completely returned throughout history. So I don't know how anyone could, but I get it. If you've never contemplated humanity at all, that makes sense to me.
Yeah, which is exactly what I was saying earlier. Like, this, it's not the big game-changing thing that it seems to be. And I just can't imagine the mindset you'd have to be in for that to be like a new thing to you.
I guess you skipped freshman year humanities.
Apparently.
That'd be about it. I don't know.
Yeah.
I don't know.
We usually go into spoilers. I feel like this movie isn't derived so much from plot, but I am going to start talking about, I guess, twists or conclusions to some of these timelines.
We're still reviewing this movie?
Well, I want to talk about two things in general, and then we can end this. There are just two aspects that closed out two different timelines that I'd like to bring up. So if you consider knowing things about that, spoilers, then spoiler warning. What did you think about the eventual reveal that the fabricants were being butchered like chickens and fed to themselves?
I mean, it made me immediately go out and buy a bucket of KFC. But other than that, I really didn't have much of a reaction.
The scene I
literally ate chicken after I saw this movie.
I ate chicken right before and right after I saw this movie.
It's probably too much poultry. You should cut back on that.
Well, it wasn't like chicken like at the box office and then chicken out in the lobby. Like, that was just my two meals.
No, I actually ate chicken at the Lincoln Center box office, funny enough.
Damn. Danny, did you eat chicken after seeing this movie?
I had a chicken sandwich yesterday, so
Okay, so I think this movie is really by the poultry concerns, and we've all been duped. Well done. I don't know. I think that they even kind of... There's a point where... what's his name? Jim Broadbent's character in the old folks' home starts screaming, like, Soylent Green is people.
Mm-hmm.
Apropos of nothing, basically, when he's trying to escape. And then all of a sudden, it's like, oh, holy shit. Like, Soylent Green is people. Well, fabricants, I guess. Like, was anyone surprised by that?
I mean, I was surprised that the fabricants were actually real. I assumed that they were some sort of, like, anamorphic, like, robot. So then I was like, oh, they're okay. So that surprised me.
And I think that's one of the problems I had with that whole scene that hopefully would be a little better explained in the book, is the idea that I didn't understand that society at all.
Yeah, that part of the book is much more elaborate. It's basically written as the interview between them, so it reads like a transcript.
Okay.
And... I mean, they basically explain all the rules and stuff. So, I was even getting confused in some of those parts of the movies having read the book just because...
Yeah,
because,
like, Like, I know about 2012, the 70s, the 30s, and, you know, the 1700s. Like, I'm pretty cool with that. But when you start getting into the future, that's when you're going to need to pick up a little bit and, like, help me out. And they, like, do nothing to help you with that. So that reveal... to me, which should have been, because, like, that image is terrifying academically. Like, if I cared about people in that future, I would probably be, you know, really concerned about that. But
you didn't care about you seriously? You didn't care about Sanmi? And I'm actually asking that as a serious question.
No, I didn't, because I thought she was. No, because I, up until a certain point, didn't even realize that she had a consciousness. Like, she was talking about when they first introduce her. They ask her a question, and she defines the word truth. And I thought that, I'm like, okay, she has a brain like a computer. She's like, it's like Wikipedia or something. She's like a human manifestation of Clippy from, like, Microsoft Office 05.
Oh.
I didn't realize that she had...
Fuck you, I love Clippy.
I love Clippy too, but I don't cry every time that I click the X to make him go away. Like, I assumed that these were, like, organic goldfish who were trained for a purpose and immediately just reset every day.
Mm-hmm. See, that's fair, because I actually did think that myself at first, which did put me at a distance, but when it was established that she wasn't, I did actually care about that character. I think I don't want to say the most sympathetic in the entire film, but one of the most sympathetic.
But see, that's almost cheating to make her the sympathetic character, because she is, like, the... It's like when they kill a kid. Like, you know, it's just like that's such a cheap way to get.
No, I think she's an interesting character, though.
I think
seeing her growth is compelling.
I didn't see any growth.
It was also fairly quick. She read, like, a quote, and then she got all these screens, and they started, like, reading good quotes, and then she became a revolutionary, I guess.
Yeah, it's just like
Well, it's not that she became a revolutionary. It's that she made a simple action, which is why there's the line about how, you know, will anybody believe your story? Well, one person does.
Yeah.
And the idea is that that alone is enough in this sort of society. It's not that she becomes a revolutionary. It's just that the place she's living in is so oppressive that any thought that goes against the grain that can get anybody's attention has the ability to make an impact.
Which is actually the plot of Serenity.
I've never seen that movie.
Oh, it's pretty good. Okay, so that was one. And then what do you think about the post-Earth ending? That's kind of like a Twilight Zone-y reveal when old future Tom Hanks is talking to the kids, and, like, this has apparently all been his story, and how those kids kept up with it and how he, you know, or it makes you consider the movie in a whole way, because maybe he's old and senile and he just keeps, like, switching stories because he forgets what he's talking about. But, yeah, they say, like, you know, what can you tell us about, like, leaving Earth, or which one is Earth? And he points to a shimmering blue dot off in the night sky.
Y'all children, that's Earth up there.
At least I could understand him better in the closing scene than the opening one. That was a plus.
Yeah.
I actually, during that opening scene, I sort of got the impression of, like, an Ed Wood film. Old man makeup. And it's... he's talking about voice and he has the stick. And I was almost, I mean, not, obviously it would be terrible if it was like an Ed Wood movie, but I was sort of hoping the rest of the film would be like that.
Oh, man. I mean, I just didn't know if like anyone had a reaction to that. Like, we've left Earth, but we're still people. Like, is that?
Do you want to know my actual reaction?
Yeah.
Oh, that was my actual reaction. I mean, it's like, great. Okay, cool. Because, yeah, it's like humanity is the only thing that matters. So it's like, my question was like, what planet were they on? Because they seem to be living fairly high on the hog. And it's like, that ain't like Mars. Like I said, Jupiter.
And they could still, they see Earth like a shimmering, like they see Earth better than we see Venus.
Yeah, it's got to be close.
It's, yeah, they have to have like terraformed Mars or something. Like that's all I can think of.
Yeah, and but who did it?
I don't know.
Let's watch Prometheus.
Oh, Jesus. Okay. That's a perfect note to end this on. Okay. So, Cloud Atlas, those are our thoughts. Let's actually just sum this up in a single word. Go to the theater to see this movie. Yes or no?
Yes.
Yes. Yeah.
Okay. No. No. No, no, no. No. No.
That's many words.
It's the same word repeated.
Cheating.
How many yeses would you have given this movie if you could?
To combat your no's, 3. I would give 3 yeses. I go, yes, yes, yes.
I like how there, your yeses get less firmed up as they go. Yeah. Before we move on, I want to spend like 1 second, well, not 1 second, literally 1 minute talking about Wake and Fright. We talked about it a few weeks ago. We all saw an online screener, and I got the opportunity to see an actual 35mm print of this film at AFI Silver in Silver Spring. And I know that I had said that we had some, or that I personally had some issues with the character, the protagonist whose name escapes me right now. Oh, John. And I know that I personally said that I had some issues with his transformation from a seemingly jovial guy into a hate-filled jerk towards everyone. In the movie, when you see it on the big screen, it actually does play a lot better, and you get a much better sense of his transformation and the fact that there's always kind of a seed of disdain in him from the beginning. So retroactively amending my review of Wake and Fright to take that out since it actually is there. And it's gorgeous. If you get a chance to see it on the big screen, you totally should. So yeah, that's it. Now we can move on into our look at the week ahead. I know we spent a lot of time on Cloud Atlas, so we're going to try to run through this as quick as possible. Like, really not discuss the film so much as just throw out the ones that we think are best. So coming to DVD and Blu-ray, we have The Campaign, which was with Will Ferrell and Zach Galifianakis. Safety Not Guaranteed, which has Aubrey Plaza, Jake Johnson, and Mark Duplass. Then we have Ruby Sparks, which has Paul Dano. First Position, Elena, A Christmas Story 2, and Coma, which was the A&E special that was produced by the Scott Brothers. So anyone see any of these and think that they're worth checking out?
Ruby Sparks was pretty good. Safety Not Guaranteed is pretty good too.
Yeah, Safety Not Guaranteed I saw, and that was fantastic. So I would definitely say that you should check that out.
Yeah, don't forget the Alfred Hitchcock Masterpiece Blu-ray Collection.
Ooh, how expensive is that?
Which they had to recall. It was supposed to come out about a month ago, but I guess there were problems with the credits of Frenzy or something.
Oh, I remember.
It was like really weird errors that shouldn't be present because they changed the opening credits for whatever reason.
Yeah, I remember reading about that. And they were like,
I read a review on a High Def Digest, which says that it's kind of a mixed bag, but I guess the movies that you care about look good. So,
all right. Like, did you see?
I would like to buy it. It's just a little expensive. If you get it from Amazon UK, it's actually only about $150.
Jesus.
only.
Well, in the United States, it's like $230.
Okay, yeah, only. Yeah, that makes sense. Given some context, yeah, I agree with you. Mike, did you see any of these? Did you want to throw out anything that you thought was worth checking out?
I mean, I'm dying to see A Christmas Story 2 because I want to see if Ralphie keeps his eye. That's pretty much it.
All right. So let's move on to...
The parents get a divorce.
Holy shit. Let's move on into what's coming out in theaters November 2nd. We have Wreck-It Ralph, which is the video game cameo fest Actually doesn't look that bad. The Man with the Iron Fists, which looks like it could be campy fun. Flight, which I've heard good things about, and marks Robert Zemeckis' return to live action. This Must Be the Place, which I've never heard of, but stars Sean Penn and Frances McDormand. A Late Quartet, The Details, The ABCs of Death, which I feel like came out previously. Yeah, that's about it. Anyone have a specific one of these that they think is the best bet for the coming week?
I would say Flight is probably your best bet, although...
Is this one that you've seen already?
I haven't seen it, but I feel like even the week ahead is a little messy, but Flight is probably the safest bet. I would say that.
Yeah.
I'm actually going to do a double feature of that and The Man with the Iron Fists. I feel like that'll be
interesting. That is a great double feature.
I'm looking forward to The Man with the Iron Fists in a very curious fashion.
Yeah, I'm actually kind of looking forward to it as well.
Yeah,
and I'm looking forward to Flight.
This Must Be the Place played at Cannes in 2011, actually, alongside The Tree of Life. So those were two Sean Penn movies there at the same time, which kind of maybe should say something. Our review of it was not very good at the time, but the trailer for it is fantastic. And it stars Sean Penn as like a sort of a Robert Smith-esque burned-out rock star.
Okay.
And it just looks so fascinating. I really do want to see it.
Yeah, I want to see Flight because I want to know how rolling a plane saves it from crashing. Like that trailer worked on me only in so far as I like need to know what the hell happens. And Denzel Washington looks like he gives a typically great performance in it as well. So I'm looking forward to that. Wreck-It Ralph seems okay, but I don't know. I don't know if that's for me. Danny and Mike, any opinions on these?
I'm definitely going to see Wreck-It Ralph, if only because of the Toy Story thing. Like, when my mom watched Toy Story, she kept freaking out. She's like, it's the Army Men! I had these as a kid! And I grew up pretty much raised by video games, and it's Disney, so I'm going to see Wreck-It Ralph.
Nice.
And the RZA made a Kung Fu movie. Who in America would not see Man with the Iron Fists? I don't get it.
Exactly.
And the soundtrack is fantastic. That song with the RZA and the Black Keys will get me into the theater alone. So I'm down for both.
All right. And Danny, what about yourself?
I actually saw Flight, and I'm a major fan of that movie. I don't know why Rotten Tomatoes says it's an hour and 33 minutes long, because the movie I saw at the New York Film Festival was 2 hours and 20 minutes. And it's a pretty dark very good character study with a great performance, and hopefully I don't know if we'll be talking about it, but if we are, I look forward to it.
I believe that's what we're talking about.
Okay,
next week.
Cool.
Unless anyone wants to talk about like Wreck-It Ralph, if you think that's going to be the deeper, no? Okay, we're going to keep with Flight then. That's great. So that is our recommendations for what you should check out in theaters. And now we can get into our random recommendations of things that we've seen during the week. So, Mike, why don't you tell us something that you watched during the week, you know, TV, DVD, Blu-ray, repertory, theater. Let us know what we should look for.
Well, mine's a bit hacky, but it's the one that I sort of watched in anticipation for Cloud Atlas. Someone mentioned how it was like 2001, A Space Odyssey. So I was like, okay, fired that DVD back up again. And Cloud Atlas is nothing like 2001.
Nothing like 2001.
In any way, shape, or form. But once again, I was just struck at just the marvel of how well Kubrick just takes an entire medium and plays with it as he so wants, diverting everything, turning it on its head. And it struck me again. One of those things that sort of comes up like, oh yes, that's right, orange juice is tasty. Once again, Stanley Kubrick is good at the making of movies.
All right. Yeah, it's funny that you say that, because like someone had said, you know, it had a Fountain vibe to it, and maybe they were just going off of synopsis, but that's nothing like the Fountain either. Cloud Atlas, just, I don't know. Nick, what was something that you watched that you think we should check out?
I'm going to throw out a 2012 title here, actually. Last night after Cloud Atlas, I saw Holy Motors, which is not a combination I would recommend, because the two movies, when you see them together, will kind of weigh down on your brain. But I think we all know what the film is, directed by Leos Carax, stars Denis Levant. And it's good. While at the same time a bit frustrating, because it is, I think, more an interesting experiment than it is an entirely satisfying experience. But it is unlike anything you'll see in theaters these days, like Cloud Atlas, actually. So maybe it is a good double feature. I don't know. But it features one of the best performances of the year from Mr. Levant himself, and wonderful filmmaking, too. And it's funny, and it's disgusting, and it's oppressive, and it's joyous, and it'll at the end you'll be scratching your head.
You know, I've heard a lot of really good things about that film. I haven't read any of them because I'm trying to keep myself as unprofaned as possible before I go and see it. But I mean, you know, I've seen a lot of really good headlines, so I'm looking forward to getting a chance to check that out. Danny, what about yourself?
I spent some time catching up on a classic that I hadn't seen, which was Robert Altman's Three Women. And it's funny because we've been talking about movies that, especially in our discussion, that have had a tough time getting made. And this is a movie that got greenlit because Robert Altman had a dream about making a movie with Shelley Duvall and Sissy Spacek, and he put together some little half-baked treatment and somehow got enough money and backing to make this movie. And if you've seen it, you know, there's it's almost unthinkable how something like that was able to get enough money to be made, but it's a really great movie. The first hour is kind of this hilarious comedy about two women that don't belong in society at all. They're total freaks. And then the last hour really gets kind of dark and messed up, and it doesn't end in any kind of conventional fashion, but it's still very satisfying in terms of just how deep it goes into this abyss.
Yeah, for the record, I hate that movie with the passion of a thousand suns.
But and I completely can just understand why, just like automatically.
The passion of a thousand suns.
Yeah, I'm not a big Altman fan in general, to be honest.
So. Well, yeah, I mean, have you seen this one or?
No, I've seen several others though, and overall, I am very lukewarm on him.
Yeah, I'm pretty ambivalent on the guy too.
I love Altman and A Thousand Suns.
So. But you hate that movie.
Oh God, so much more than you hate Cloud Atlas, Brian.
Here's the thing: I think at the end of the day, when I look back at Cloud Atlas, I'm not going to feel hatred. Now that like, as I distance myself from the fact that I had to give that movie $10 and sit in a theater for 3 hours, as I look back on it, it won't be hatred. It's going to be like bafflement and apathy. Like, it was so fucking dull.
You see, but that's how you grow as a person. So the next you will be kinder and gentler.
Towards Cloud Atlas.
Yes, absolutely.
Okay. Great. Myself, I went to the AFI Silver, which I'm plugging for the second time on this show, apparently. And I saw the 1922 classic Nosferatu. Yeah. So since it's Halloween, I figured I'd talk about that one. I don't know. How much do I have to say about it? I feel like everyone knows it. It's the vampire horror film by Murnau. It's a silent film. I saw it with a live quartet accompaniment with a newly commissioned score. So that was pretty awesome. And yeah, it's surprising how good that movie is. There's a little bit of unintentional comedy in it now, just because, I don't know, it's the type of thing. It's a movie out of time, so there's some... some of the tricks they use in it are a little weird, like to convey the speed of the Dracula's carriage, you know, they just sped the camera up. So, you know, it's like the type of things that you would do like when you first get a video camera as like a child and you want to be a filmmaker, you know, starting it taping and then immediately stopping and then moving something a fraction of an inch to have like a stop motion thing. But it's just really interesting to look back and see like what they were doing then and how successful it was. And Max Schreck's work as, you know, Nosferatu is just fucking fantastic. Like, he's still creepy as hell. And that iconic scene where he raises out of the coffin just carries the same impact that it did then. And also, it's just interesting to watch because of the story of that film and how, like, apparently Stoker's wife had gotten a court injunction to have every copy destroyed. And they just kept making copies and like passing them around, and every time one would crop up, she'd try to destroy it. I mean, like, that's weird, and it's awesome that, you know, you can still go to a theater and see a copy of it now.
Yeah, we showed her.
Yeah, we did. But yeah, has anyone else seen Nosferatu Among Us?
Yeah.
Yeah, of course.
Yeah.
I still haven't seen Herzog's remake, though. I think, didn't you mention that, Nick, like a couple weeks ago or something?
Yeah, I actually like that more than Murnau's version.
What? I'll have to check it out now.
Mostly because of Klaus Kinski, who I think is maybe the best on-screen vampire I've ever seen.
Pretty high praise. Or is it?
Especially after Hugo Weaving in Cloud Atlas. Yeah, never mind.
Yeah. Man, every time old Georgie came on the screen, I started laughing. And at a point, I was like, man, I really have to stop doing this because there might be people enjoying this film. Anyway, that brings us to the end. Next week, we will be talking about Flight. And then the week after that, we can talk about Skyfall.
Ooh.
I'm really excited for that movie, guys.
I saw it 2 weeks ago.
I fucking hate you, Newman. I am the host of this show. Why am I not seeing these?
Yeah, but you don't live in New York, so don't feel bad about that.
I'm gonna work my way up there. No, I'm not. That's a lie. Anyway, so ladies and gentlemen, thank you for joining us. Let us say where we can be found on the internet in the interim. Mike, we'll start with you because you're the guest.
Oh, thank you. Thank you, gentlemen, for having me off the spirited discussion of the much acclaimed and widely loved film, Cloud Atlas.
Universally loved.
All of us, giant smiles, high fives, thumbs up, big fans. You can find me at my gig space, theinclusive.net, and kicking around, doing some reviews for the film stage, of course.
And Danny?
Thefilmstage.com as well. My personal blog is thekingbulletin.com and twitter.com/thekingbulletin.
And Nick?
Twitter.com/Nick_Newman and thefilmstage.com.
And you can find me at thefilmstage.com as well as my personal blog, dearfilm.net. And yeah, you can find me at Twitter, twitter.com/BrianJRowan. So again, tune in next week when we talk about Flight, and we look forward to seeing you then.
Dear Sixsmith.
I never want to hear the name Sixsmith ever fucking again.
Rufus Sixsmith.
Hello, Sixsmith. God damn it. Anyway, like, I'm going to meet a person named Sixsmith. I'm going to punch him in his face. All right.
But their lover just killed themselves. Jesus.
I don't give a shit. Everyone has to deal with that at some point in their life.
What?
I've had three lovers kill themselves over me, so I understand completely.
Right. Don't date artists, man. That's like if I can pass one piece of advice on to literally anyone, don't date artists. Never date an artist. Writers, composers, painters, photographers, they're all crazy.
Brian, you forget about the masochists among us who enjoy such things.
Yeah, that's true. Like, you think it's great when you wake up and like your girlfriend's cutting off her hair because her new painting isn't going well and she's like crying, you're like, "Oh, she cares." It's like, "No, that's going to blow back on you one day." Anyway, moving on. Cloud Atlas.